Mrs. Cormor real to?
I went to find the farmer's wife to ask her, where do I put the sixth cow? And she said, there are only five. Knowing that I had had a drop of wine, I thought twice, but no, there were six cows. And we discovered then that one had come through a hole in the wire. At the same time, a very irate neighbour was rushing through the courtyard, claiming that I had stolen a cow of his. This cost me my job.
Now, can we go back to the training period?
Yes.
And how long was it after the period of training that the arrangements were made for you to be taken to France?
Exactly how many days, I can't remember. There was a slight leave, a very short time of leave. Then also there was a security training as well, which lasted a week. After that, there was the jump training, another week. I returned from that on a Friday and was in France on the Sunday.
The jump training being for a parachute jump?
Yes.
Can you describe in detail the actual process of transfer to France, how it was accomplished?
Well, we had a house not too far from the airfield, and there I was taken on a Sunday afternoon, given a wonderful meal. I thought at the time, this is the condemned man's last meal, but it soon went over. Then I was taken over to the field, to the dressed up in my jumpsuit, and went into the aircraft, said good evening to the crew, who lined up on each side of the hole through which I had to climb. We took off on a beautiful sunset in England, and it lasted much longer than it would nowadays, but still at one moment I was given a nice hot drink by the dispatcher, and then I saw he opened the hole in the floor of the fuselage, so it told me that we were soon going to do something. He came and attached my cord, my silk cord, to the side of the aircraft, because it was one of those chutes that I had, and told me to get ready in my thoughts. And also, at that moment, I could see the red light coming up on the side, and I knew that when the green light came on and the dispatcher gave me the signal, I had to slide through the hole. This happened. It went very, very well indeed. The slipstream from, because we had prop aircrafts at those times, not jets, the slip from the motors carried me off. I was sitting like in an armchair, like this, perfectly comfortable, and slowly but surely my chute opened up on its own, and I didn't even feel the jerk on my shoulder. My legs then, when I got away from the slipstream, slowly went down and I could see the ground. It was only just over 300 feet, so it wasn't a long drop, which was very safe.
What colour was the parachute?
My parachute was white, dirty white. I've got a piece of it still.
And when you dropped, what were you actually taking with you physically?
Physically, I only had a handbag with money on, which was round a strap behind my back, filling in one's back, where like that, cushioning in a way the lower vertebrae, the spine, so that the shock wouldn't damage anything. I was dressed in normal, what I thought was normal for France, a black coat and skirt with a silk blouse. And that went very well indeed. And black shoes. My ankles were bandaged in case, try and prevent anything, as I was in shoes and not in jump boots. So that was that. I took off my jumpsuit immediately and handed it to the French people who were meeting me. They hid it beautifully, apparently. After the war, the daughter of the farmer who had received me on his field, if I can put it that way. It was more his meadow. He received me there. He and his wife were unfortunately later taken prisoner to concentration camps in Germany, and he did not return. His wife has returned, indeed. And the daughter, of course, has now married a grandmother and all that, and her husband used my jumpsuit after the war and used to go on his motorbike in this jumpsuit. A remark he made to me a few years ago, how marvellous were all those zip fasteners everywhere.
Was the landing accurate?
Perfectly accurate, yes. I was able to tell my pilot when I returned to England once by chance, bang on.
Can you remember the dates that you dropped?
22nd of August.
1943. And what was the exact area that you dropped in?
The exact area was the hamlet of Saint-Antoine-du-Quéré, and that is in the Gironde, about 125 kilometres northeast of Bordeaux.
Why was that particular area chosen, do you know?
No, I could not give that answer. It was a very good spot, and if it hadn't been for this denunciation within fortnight, 3 weeks later, I don't know the exact date of the denunciation, we would have used it much more, but we had to cut away when we found all the people had been taken.
You mentioned circuits earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
Was this particular area one particular circuit? Is that the term you used?
No, circuit in English meant all the areas of a leader. My boss had this whole ear. The name of our circuit was Wheelwright, and that covered about 8 departments, really. But it did cover lots of places in the southwest. There were other circuits in the southwest too, independent from us.
Was Saint-Antoine-du-Quéré a particular département?
It's in the Gironde. If you want further details, it's just by the Saint-Emilion wine. I could have put out my hand and picked some of the grapes because I arrived there just before harvest.
So the name of the département was Gironde?
Gironde, yes.
And how many people actually met you in the dropping zone?
The reception committee consisted of 5 men. One I mentioned already, whose land it was, and 4 others. Then they took me up to a barn where the wife, who was also deported, was there too. Unfortunately, one of the traitors was one of the other 4.
Was he already a traitor at that time?
I don't know. He didn't seem like it. I didn't like the man because I had to go and meet them all in full daylight the next day and discuss things. And I didn't like the way he looked at me. But I'll admit this, they had all been together all their lives, on the school benches, in work and everything. It was a terrible thing to do, but he did it for money.
How did he look at you?
Very underhand way. I would not have trusted him with anything. Saying that he had an English friend nearby and he would bring her along to meet me the next day, so I insisted on my host that I was not going to be in the house, that I'd gone away. So they told this story to him that I'd gone.
Was this a genuine English person?
No, I think she was a German.
What did you do next?
Well, then I went down to the Pyrenees, at the foot of the Pyrenees, where my boss was at the time. We had our first meeting, and we met at a wayside station. I got out the train sooner than I should have, went back in the train to go to a town, and the next day he came along to the house where I was in the town. and we discussed whatever we were going to do, the strategy and all that. He sent me back to where I had dropped. That's what he wanted. He thought it was a good spot for getting ready. And on top of that, he had full confidence in the people of the house. I told him about this other chap, and he said, well, you'll only stay there 3 days and mention what you think. You have my permission to mention your feelings to the leader of the group, which I did. So I only stayed 3 days there, and then I went off. But it was from there that I had my first contact with England by the radio.
Who was this boss?
His name, at the end of the war, he was Lieutenant Colonel George Starr. His code name is Elair.
And how long had he been in France?
He'd been there since November 42. Organizing his circuit, setting it up, and finding the people, recruiting people, asking for grounds up where parachute drops could happen and that sort of thing, telling them what he intended to do at D-Day, about the sabotage of railways, of electric pylons, all of that sort of thing. And then he asked for a radio operator because the courier was too slow a job to get people right up to Switzerland or even across the Pyrenees to Spain to get them back to England. It was a bit too slow. So he asked for an operator. I must admit he'd put a condition, owing to the recruiting by the enemy of young men for obligatory labour in Germany. That went up to the age of 35. He therefore asked for someone over the age of 35 to go out, to be sent out to him as radio operator. London's answer would have sent him a woman. He must have cursed.
Did he show any displeasure?
Funnily enough, I realised as I first saw him and when he first saw me that he had been an acquaintance of my husband's. So that, well, he felt a double responsibility, if I can put it that way. Knowing my husband had been killed, he looked after me extremely well indeed. And I'm very grateful to all the work he did for looking after me. And that's why he wouldn't let me have a pistol. That's why he gave me so many identity cards. That's why he arranged houses very safely all the time.
Can you describe him as a man?
As a man, physically?
And
he was
in character?
In character. Physically, he was small. He was no taller than I am. A man who had celebrated, I should say, his 40th birthday in the field. His main feature were his eyes. He really hypnotized people into doing what he wanted by looking at them. Nothing disagreeable, but he sort of had a forceful way, and even today, he died unfortunately 3 years ago, but even today his men speak of him as a wonderful boss.
What about his character?
Character? A very nervous man, indeed, very generous. He looked after his people very well. He took duty and responsibility as two extremely important words for his job there. And he never asked anyone to do something he couldn't do himself, except the radio. That he had not been trained in doing, so that, and he didn't bother about coding in and decoding or any repairs. But otherwise, he would not ask a man to do, or a woman to do something he hadn't done himself, he said. And I think he carried that out throughout. His main defect, if I can call it that way, smoked too much. Always had a cigarette. And his hands, we had to give him pumice stone so as to get rid of all his nicotine. But he did give it away, always the smoking, very nervous. and a special kind, a special brand of cigarettes, a Balto, a French cigarette, luckily.
What was the brand?
Balto, B-A-L-T-O.
Was the heavy smoking of any significance in the job he had to do?
No, I think it was to calm his nerves.
But it wasn't of any particular disadvantage to him in doing the job?
No, that's certainly not, because he did take the French cigarette. We had at one moment in the summer of 43 an RAF aircraft with a crew, the Polish crew, because they worked beautifully during the war too, but they were shot down, and we had this remark made to us. The poor fellows still had their English cigarettes, and people didn't have any French cigarettes to give them, and they went out, unfortunately, in the open. They smoked English cigarettes, so they quickly had to be brought in, because the English smoking English cigarettes is recognizable at once. So they had to be hidden for their smoking, if I put it, they were told that. But we got them very soon. We got them away back to England. I've even heard from one who went straight on to Vancouver and still living there.
So you told Hilaire that about your suspicions about the chap who turned out to be a traitor.
Yes.
It seems remarkable that after seeing him such a short time that you'd picked him out and that he was actually the one who was a traitor.
I'm told that I have a lot of feminine I can't even say the word, intuition. And somehow that's it. And I never thought before, when I'd met him casually, I must admit, in Brussels, that I would trust this man, Hilaire, with my life. But I followed his instructions all throughout, and it worked beautifully.
What had Hilaire done in civilian life?
Mining engineer.
So after, how long was your meeting with Hilaire on this first occasion?
On the very first occasion, I should think only about 11, 12 minutes, just between 10 and 15, but more nearer 10 than 15. We had a short walk along the road. I gave him a photograph of his wife and children and a little note from his wife, and then I went back to the station to take the train down to Morhejou again. He went another way.
Down to where?
The town of Morhejou, which is at the foot of the Pyrenees. It's the last town with a train.
So then you returned to the place where you'd been dropped, to Saint-Antoine?
Yes, once more, but that was the last time. They had been very good, too. They'd imagined that I should hide my set in one of their big barrels, the ones into which they first put all the grapes. This is before the grape harvest, you see, the vendange. And they put a false bottom in there and managed that from the floor, from the ground, I could put my set into it. And I must admit, it worked very well indeed.
What type of information were you transmitting to England?
Well, at that time, it was telling them about these five Poles who were going to be repatriated to England. We soon had that fixed up. Another one giving some more dropping zones. Things like that were the first messages.
What were these dropping zones exactly?
Well, dropping zones were fields like the one on which I had landed. Mine happened to be a meadow, but that was a detail. It was like that, would be covered with grass if possible. Then that is, how shall I say, the land where they would parachute containers or people. They had to be looked for because they had to be clear with nothing dangerous if possible, not too many trees, and yet not be too visible.
What type of things would they drop apart from personnel?
They did throw down packages. For instance, my radios came down as packages, each one separately. Of the three, only one worked on. Unfortunately, we lost two.
From impact?
One completely destroyed by impact. The second one was all right, but the man who put it on his bike to transport it was caught immediately. He should never have done that. It was against Hilaire's orders that he did so, and therefore the Germans had it immediately. So I was left with one radio set, which I had to use before the next ones came, end of January 44.
What instruction had this chap broken?
Hilaire had told him that he was not to transport a radio set, not to go about with a radio set. And he thought he'd quickly do it, and he fell into a barrage with the enemy.
Fell into a?
Barrage, that is to say, they were examining, like customs, examining everything the people were carrying, whether carrying on a bicycle, whether in a car, whether by hand.
This was a roadblock, was it?
Yes, that sort of thing. But it was in the town, that's why I didn't call it a roadblock.
But presumably the set would have to be retrieved anyway.
Oh, it had been retrieved from the dropping zone, you see. They'd examined the three. One was visibly out of use. The other two were supposed to be hidden. One man took one and hid it perfectly, and therefore I had it when I came. And the other one, this man took it, saying he was going to hide it, you see, but he shouldn't have gone in daylight through a barrage.
What type of messages would you be receiving from Britain?
Instructions mainly, or else acceptance of the dropping zones, the grounds that we mention, telling us that they'd like this to be done or that to be done. I covered those things.
What kind of wavelengths would you be using?
Oh, goodness. That's beyond me for the moment. I would have to look up what I had.
Was it not very easy for the Germans to be able to detect a transmitter?
Well, if the transmitter came up regularly at the same place, then definitely very much. But I must admit that by 44, they'd got it down. I've seen a report which was obtained from the Gestapo at Osh, where they said they knew there was an English woman in the region, that this radio was clandestine because it was transmitting in five-letter groups, and also it was a woman's fist on the key. So they were looking for that person. They found someone who was willing to talk, a Spaniard, one of the communists, Spaniards, who had left Spain, running away from Franco. And he said, yes, in that village of Castelnau, there is an English woman with a radio set. So the Germans started looking for someone in all these villages, because there were, in one department, eight Castelnaus. They all had a second barrel name. They were either on a river or high or low or something like that. They never happened to come to the one where I did go back from time to time, quite often towards the end, because this was such a hamlet, there was no electricity, no running water, just one well. And in their methodic way, they decided no English woman would live in such primitive conditions.
Who was the Spaniard exactly?
I don't know his name, his real name, because of course he had another name, he gave another name, but they found it was him, but where he went to afterwards, if he was alive or anything, we don't know, but it was on the German paper that this had been given by one of the Spaniards who'd come to the village of Castelnau and seen me.
So you didn't know this manager yourself?
No, I didn't know him.
So your only knowledge of him was through this...
Document of the Gestapo.
Can you describe your everyday life in the area, what it was like?
There's nothing much one can describe, really, because I did have those little jobs at the beginning, but we soon found that that was impossible to carry out, to continue with that, so that I really, in a way, was left to my own devices. In whatever house I was, I tried to help in the housework. It was about all I could do. Quite a lot of time was taken up by coding and decoding and thinking out where would the boss be so that I could get the message as soon as possible to him and things like that. Get on my bike and perhaps it would be a 50-kilometer ride to get the message to him and come back. Well, of course, that took a certain amount of my day, too.
Who was the boss?
Hilaire. But he was always called the boss, le patron, not to give any names.
When you got to France, did anything about the way of life as it was in 43-44 take you by surprise, as compared with what you'd experienced before?
Well, I would have to stress here that it was a completely different kind of life to what I'd lived before, and I didn't even have any idea of this sort of life. Yes, I've lived in the country, but of course private houses, so that it was different in that way to begin with. And of course this was wartime, where you couldn't get the food as you wanted, you couldn't get anything as you wanted, you had to be careful. I must admit to butterflies floating in my tummy all the time. You had to have your eyes in the back of your head as well as in front. So the life was totally different to anything I'd experienced previously. Mainly, I'm a town dweller, so to be all the time in the country, which was what the boss preferred, you see, was a great contrast. The way of life was totally different, very primitive still, especially under the conditions of electricity cutting off and just one fire in the kitchen and sticking there by it. It was usually wood fires too, on which the cooking was done, simply because you had no other fuel.
What did the attitudes of the French people in the locality seem to be towards the German regime?
Well, they were, if they accepted me to be there with them, of course they were all pro-Allies. But we mustn't forget the fact, which I found out afterwards, it was only about 8% of the population of the country who were actually asked to do something, actively engaged in the resistance. They didn't want more, because to have too many people in the know was doubling, quadrupling the danger of something being said. So you got the few, the number who collaborated, we leave that aside, but you also got